Rob.
And I'm Dave.
And you're listening to our third and final cold take on the Star Wars prequels. Tonight, Dave, we're going to be talking about 2005's Revenge of the Sith.
We are bringing this trilogy of alternate galaxies to a close with the one that I think is the fan favourite.
Absolutely. Hands down.
Excellent. Once again, no spoilers because this is a 19-year-old film.
Exactly right.
We're just going to dive into it.
Yeah, and we always dive in with our backgrounds to these movies when we first saw them. And for me, I looked this up. This was the 19th of May 2005 that it dropped in Australia. So I was actually 10 days off turning 30. Wife number one had come and gone at this point in time, Dave. I was dating a pastry chef from the Four Seasons in Sydney. Okay. Now, I'm pretty sure I didn't watch it with her, though. I can't actually remember seeing any movies with her. But I did watch it with some company at a midnight screening because I remember being in the queue, and this is the interesting part of the story. I remember being in the queue with this person and then seeing an IT journalist from my days in IT journalism. And I sort of reached out across the line to say hi, and he kind of brushed me. It's funny the things you remember, isn't it? Like, you know, and I don't remember who I was with on the night, but I do remember the guy who brushed me, even though I was just saying hi to him. And I recall saying to my companion, who I can't remember, hey, that was blah, blah, blah from blah, blah magazine. And my companion saying, well, he's a dick, isn't he? And that's my big memory from being in line for the film.
I can actually remember a lot more of the lead up to this one because although we've gone back and looked at The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones and found the good and the bad and all the rest of it, they really had settled, I think, in the collective memory of a lot of fans, and particularly my circle of friends, as being pretty ordinary movies. Mm. And there was a lot of sort of hesitation about, is this going to bring home the trilogy or not? And I do remember somebody circulating a review that Kevin Smith did when he saw an advanced screening that was very much pitched at, come on, guys, you've got to get behind this movie. It's going to be worthwhile. And I did actually track down this review, and the opening paragraph says very straightforward, Revenge of the Sith is quite simply awesome. This is the Star Wars prequel the haters have been bitching for since Menace came out, and if they don't cop to that when they finally see it, they're lying. As dark as Empire was, this movie goes 1,000 times darker.
Mm, bit of hyperbole there.
Bit of hyperbole from Kevin Smith? No, surely not.
At least he's not crying.
At least no. And so look, a bunch of us did go and see this again at midnight. There wasn't a fan-organised event we went to this time. It was just the Hoyts on our Burke Street. We booked a midnight session. And by then, the cinemas had got quite slack in terms of, you know, how quickly they got to the movie. And so I remember as the time ticked past 12:30 and we were still on trailers and adverts, sitting there going, why are we doing this? And Rob from 42 to Doomsday then turned to us and said, exactly, why are we here? We hated the first two movies. Why are we doing this? And then we all sort of sat down and watched it. This is the only one of the three that I saw twice in the cinema. And this is the one I have confirmed that Mark Chook did go and see, I think, 6 or 7 times over the weekend with sort of a different friend every time.
Right. Right. I do have an answer, though, for why we go to see these things even when we hate the first couple of movies. It's because there was 3 bloody years in between each movie, and you just forgive and forget over 3 years, I think.
Absolutely. Plus that just wish and hope that there's going to be a really good one around the corner. And look, also, as much as we bag the first two films, there was stuff in there to enjoy.
Absolutely. I mean, my take on the first film was reasonably positive.
Yeah.
The second one, not so much.
Yeah, so look, as much as we like to bag them, they did exist in a positive place for the most part.
Yeah. Shall we get into the film?
We should.
Dave, I want to talk about the opening of the movie, because obviously this is what everyone sees first, and I think it has by far the best opening of all the prequels. It's quite exciting to see the two Jedi fighters screaming along, but when they pull around that capital ship, and you see this major fleet action above Coruscant, it's a genuine wow moment. Possibly the first big wow moment since Episode 4, where the Star Destroyer flies over your head.
Yeah, I agree with that absolutely. I thought the opening of the others wasn't too bad, but this had a really, really strong opening. And it was a contender. I'll highlight now, it was a contender for my play of the week. It is just a really exciting opening.
Yeah. The banter between Obi-Wan and Anakin is great, and the whole segment with fighting Dooku, rescuing the Chancellor, then crash landing on Coruscant is fabulous. And my only gripe, to follow a thought in the previous episode we did on Attack of the Clones, is that this is the kind of Obi-Wan and Anakin I would have liked to have seen in episode 2, where there's no war going on and they're just guys having some crazy adventures and there's nothing to be uptight about. Here, they've fought in the Clone Wars for literally years, and you would expect them to be a little more shell-shocked, a little more PTSD, a little more over it. Instead, it's all jolly japes and quips, and it's great to watch, don't get me wrong. I just don't think it plays realistically against the time frame we're in and what these guys have been doing for the past few years. If we'd had fun and relaxed Anakin like this last time, and then this time he's angrier, more serious, we'd notice and we'd go, oh gosh, he's changed. This is uncomfortable. And then that might sell his downfall in the film a lot better. I think we're meant to believe the execution of Dooku pushes him over the edge, but he's so conflicted about that. I don't think the audience really registers it as being this important turning point. It's not like he does it and it's like, oh yeah, I feel great now, Sith Lord, here I come. It's not like that at all. So I do have some complications with this opening as well, but on the whole, though, just as a spectacle, I think it's marvellous.
Yeah, look, I agree with that. And the points you made there about what does and doesn't work in there leads me very much to probably the big opening points that I wanted to make.
Hit me.
I think that there are two, maybe two and a half significant problems with Revenge of the Sith. The first of them, I think we need to just mention, is this has a very big problem as a movie, because the whole point of episode 3 is to put a whole bunch of players in exactly the right spot for episode 4. And so we all know as fans going in, because we've seen the original trilogy so, so many times on video, we all know that by the end of it, Yoda has to be living in a cave on Dagobah, and Anakin has to be in the Vader suit at the side of the Emperor, and Luke has to be on Tatooine, etc., etc., etc. We know that that's got to happen, and that's not a problem, you know. You can watch Titanic and still think it's a great movie, even though you know at the start the ship sinks.
Yeah.
The problem is that there are moments in the plot or moments of character development where it would be much more natural to do something else, and you can feel Lucas just ripping the plot apart because he's got to turn them in the other direction because they have to end up somewhere.
Yeah.
And that necessity to end up in a particular place or in multiple net places, I think does affect the movie. And the other point is, I said that The Phantom Menace was a lot of great set pieces that just made no sense. I said that I liked Attack of the Clones because it was a series of set pieces with a very clear start, middle, and end that I could actually follow as a coherent story for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Revenge of the Sith is a very exciting adventure, full of bizarre moments that to me just don't make sense. And I'll talk about those all individually a little bit later. And compounded, and here's my sort of half problem, compounded by the George Lucas habit of just introducing characters in the opening crawl and assuming we've just, oh, well, that's that person. Okay, fine, I'll run with that. Mm. And then just instead I'm sitting there going, who? Why?
Yeah.
So later on this podcast, Rob, I have my list of WTF moments that I want to throw at you. But that's my big problem. Lots of action, lots of excitement and really wild things going on. But it has to do a certain number of things, and that leads to a number of WTF moments.
I'm going to pick up on that thread in just a moment, but I do want to talk about the crawl and the mentioning, say, General Grievous. And we've never heard of General Grievous before. And I guess Lucas has this idea that, well, in time there may be a show where he's in it and he'll be fleshed out in books and all of this. And at the time, I used to sort of push against that and think, oh, no, that's not right. But then I thought, well, hang on, how did I see the first Star Wars film? There was a crawl and it was talking about characters and things happening that I didn't know about. So how was that any different? There's one thing to sort of chew over, but the second thing is getting the characters into places, and I think the big one is Anakin. And I mean, what can we say about Anakin in this film? I mean, the extreme creeper vibes from the second film are gone, and this is an Anakin that doesn't have you thinking, whoa, this guy's a bit of a dick. He's quite likable in many scenes. And I think that makes it hard to sell his fall to the Sith. I do see how it's set up. He has the dreams, which are being manipulated by Palpatine. Palpatine's also getting him offside with the Jedi Council. He's also seeding this idea that people can be saved from death and just getting Anakin all mixed up. I can see all of that. I even see the way that when he slices off Mace Windu's arm, it's because he's trying to defend the ideals of the Republic. And, you know, we've got to take this guy in. We can't just execute him, even though he executed Dooku earlier in the film. But once he does that and wonders, what have I done? He seems to see no way out and he falls to the dark side. All well and good in theory, but it doesn't really work for me. Because although the Clone Wars series would come later, so people hadn't seen it when they saw this film, I don't see the Anakin of that series doing what he does in Episode 3. The more of a hero he is, the harder it is to sell this fall. And here we go with the tie into your comment. I think Lucas is between a rock and a hard place here. Yes, he has to have Anakin fall to the dark side. He has to actively want to go out and kill some kids and buddy up with a Sith Lord and all of that. But it just doesn't gel for me with this older, wiser, funnier, more worldly Anakin. The Anakin of the previous film, sure, I can see that. All the teen angst and petulance and being offered the dark side in a moment of weakness, sure, I can see him falling there. But in this film, we have this guy who, even in the midst of war, is cracking funnies and he's pretty comfortable in his own skin. That guy falls to the dark side? Seriously, George? But I do see the conundrum he had.
So I'll respond to both of those points, particularly the second one. But in regard to the first one, I do think that Star Wars does a better job of setting up the characters and that we do get proper introductions. You know, we meet Luke, we get him around the kitchen table having dinner and, you know, I want to go to Tossie Station to pick up the power converters. You know, we get all of those sort of scenes, so we work out what sort of person he is. We get to slowly meet Obi-Wan Kenobi, and then he's got a lightsaber and he's cutting someone's arms off and he's a bit more shrewder than we think and all the rest of it. Grand Moff Tarkin is introduced, you know, in a particular amount of fanfare, and then he quickly sort of moves into the, you know, you want a different target, a military target? Well, name the system. You're far too trusting. You get those scenes that actually make those characters work. And I think that those scenes are missing from this trilogy, but particularly from Revenge of the Sith.
Right. Oh, look, and there's a huge backstory to Grievous that would probably be hard to tell. I mean, he was never originally a robot. Obviously, he is an organic who has been slowly turned into a robot or a cyborg over time. But how do you tell that story?
Well, you just told it in a sentence pretty adequately, Rob. And you say there, oh, well, obviously. No, it was never obvious to me. It was just this android guy with a cough. Like, it made no sense. Even having had it explained to me, it still doesn't. But we're getting ahead to my WTF moment. Mm-hmm. Anakin, I think you're pretty much spot on, though. I do agree with you on that. I said during Attack of the Clones that I could really see the tension in Anakin. I could see that real petulance, that real angst, and that made a lot of sense. And you're right, a lot of that isn't in this performance where it needs to be. And the script for Anakin absolutely does lurch between, you know, jolly good Japers adventure buddy through to I want to kill them all. And it absolutely lurches.
Mm.
And Christensen plays each of those different roles fairly well. He plays the jolly Japes adventurer really well. His banter's great. The moments of real tension and real darkness, he's pretty good. But then there are some terrible scenes. And this again comes back to Lucas just can't write love dialogue. He can't write relationships. Some of that dialogue, particularly with Padme, is just awful and forced. And he does turn on a dime. You know, one moment he's, hey, Mace Windu, I think the Chancellor's a Sith and this is really bad, to, well, I helped you kill Mace Windu, so on my knees I go. I'm a Sith now.
Yep.
And you just don't buy any of it. And that is a script problem more than I think it's an acting problem. I'll let you respond, Rob, and then maybe I want to mention the acting as my next point.
Yeah, look, I don't have much to add because I feel exactly the same when I was watching it. And you know he's got to fall to the dark side and fall under the Emperor's sway, but just the way it was done, oh, I just didn't buy it.
I think that this movie shows the best and worst of Lucas in apotheosis. the CGI adventure and action in this is stunningly good. And yes. Lucas was a pioneer of that. These movies work really, really well because of that. When I spoke to a few people in the office today, I said, oh, I'm doing a podcast on Revenge of the Sith. Any thoughts? And all of the ones who were, you know, under 10 when they first saw this just raved about how much they loved it when they were 8 years old.
Yeah.
And we've got to give it that credit. But as a director of actors, I think he particularly falls down here. And good actors give some really bad performances in moments here. Mm. Ian McDiarmid has some just horrible lines. Some of the stuff he has to do in the confrontation with Mace Windu is just awfully bad. Some of the stuff we sort of got to go, I sense Lord Vader is in trouble. Like, clearly he's just wanting a director to go, can you do it this way? And he's just putting it out there. Even Samuel L. Jackson, a fantastic actor, he has some lines where you go, that's the take you used? You know, stuff like the, he's a Sith Lord? And you go, you couldn't have done another take on that for Sam? Like, Sam can do that better. There's so many bad takes in this that it's just amazing that a director that can do such amazing action does such terrible acting.
You reminded me of one. I'm going to admit to something here. The line where Darth Vader's just been put in his suit and the Emperor sort of sidles up to him and goes, Lord Vader, can you hear me? My wife and I actually do with our dog. Like when he's sitting there maybe looking out the window and you call him and he doesn't turn around, we'll go, Hikaru, can you hear me? And it's a total rip of this film from like 2005. I can't believe I'm admitting to that. But yeah, we sometimes say, can you hear me? To the dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that's a problem. Would you like my top three WTF moments?
Hit me.
So number one we've already covered, and that is, why is there a droid who I've never heard of before suddenly running the army and he's got a bad cough? Droids do not cough. That is just weird. That made no sense to me at the time. I know you've tried to explain it to me because, like, there's backstory. He started off as a man and then became a lizard and then, I don't know, whatever. But that's just weird. Number two, although the music's really good, and I give credit to the way this is filmed, the execution of Order 66 has always just bewildered me because the Jedi are all just picked off so extraordinarily easily, and I think that's a problem. And then what happens to Palpatine is just bizarre. The whole confrontation with Windu, and then he's weak, and is he pretending to be weak, and then he's lulling Windu into a false sense of security, and then suddenly he's got the lightning, and then it's he's suddenly got, you know, all the Emperor sort of toad face stuff going on, and I still to this day don't know, is that because the lightning was going back and burning him, or
yes,
is that how
yes.
he always looked, and now we're just not seeing the image that he was projecting? It's just all kind of bizarre and doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
and it's
dark side energy going feeding back on him and transforming him. So no, he didn't look like that under the skin. It was literally the dark side just wrecking his face, basically.
Right. So they're just sort of three examples of things that when I watch the movie, particularly the first time, I'm just going, huh?
Yeah.
What? And that detracts from the movie. And I think it's a shame because I think that Ewan McGregor is really good in this, and I think that his final confrontation with Grievous is a pretty good one, and he really carries that scene. But in the middle of it, I'm going, who is this guy, and why has he got... Did he kill a bunch of Jedi? Okay. And why has he got lizard eyes and a cough? And that bizarreness takes me out of the movie. And as we say about Doctor Who all the time, cover it with a line.
Yeah. In the way they kill him, they show how organic he is. You know, Obi-Wan pulls his chest plate apart and you can see his heart beating, which is connected to cybernetics. And it's then Obi-Wan shoots the heart and kills him. So I think they're trying to show, not tell, but maybe a bit more tell would have been nice.
Just some tell would have been good. Yeah. Just a tiny bit. Just any tell.
You mentioned Ewan McGregor, Obi-Wan. I like this Obi-Wan more than in Attack of the Clones. I think it's probably the way he's written, but I do think, too, that the slightly older Jedi Master persona suits him a lot. I mean, he's not Alec Guinness sort of era Jedi Master, but he's just older than the second film. And McGregor gets to do some real acting in this, and some of it's quite subtle. And I want to pull out one scene when he tells Anakin that the Jedi want him to spy and report back on Palpatine, and Anakin throws a bit of a whammy and is like, I can't believe you're asking me to do this. And Obi-Wan is like, quite quietly, I'm not asking, the Jedi Council is asking. And the reply is so quiet and measured, you don't know if he even agrees with what the Jedi Council is asking. Presumably he does. But McGregor plays it in such a way there's some real ambiguity to what he really thinks. I think that's great. I think there's some real acting going on in scenes like that. And in a Star Wars movie to boot, oh yeah, I really like Ewan McGregor's take on Obi-Wan in this.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because 2 weeks ago, by the time this goes out, I, of course, saw Tamara Morrison at Supernova. Yes. And the story of that is released on was released a couple of weeks ago on the Doctor Who Show feed. And he actually particularly talked about Ewan McGregor, and he said when he was first doing the role and he had his first scene, and he's sort of like, hey, I'm in Star Wars, this is going to be really exciting, and I've got, you know, got the armor on and everything, and he's sort of going in to do a big Star Wars performance, and then he's opposite Ewan McGregor, and he just said Ewan McGregor is one of the most subtle and still actors he's ever worked with, who could just have that absolute stillness, and then with the curl of a lip, the movement of an eyebrow, could just deliver so much. And so powerfully and so effectively. And Tamara Morrison says that encouraged both him and other actors on set to go, hang on, we're not doing Star Wars, we're doing acting. And mm-hmm. and we do need to bring it down. And Ewan really did set a tone for a number of those things. And I think that Ewan McGregor does bring out better performances in the other actors he's acting against.
Well, people are going to think that was a complete setup, but you've not told me that story about Supernova before.
No,
I've not heard that before, but that is my take from watching him on screen. So I can totally buy into that because I see it. I absolutely see that.
I want to continue a little bit more on the whole Anakin plot as well, mm-hmm. because I do think it is a bit of a mixed bag. There are moments when I really sympathize with Anakin. I think Windu particularly goes out of his way to be a complete dick to Anakin. And you can sort of see how that would annoy him and that would rile him up. I could see the way they're trying to have Palpatine tempt him. And that kind of works. It needs a bit more depth and it needs a bit longer to really saturate to work properly. But it kind of works. But on the other hand, you've got his scenes with Padme, which are just awful. Natalie Portman, I said before, an actor of Samuel L. Jackson's caliber and Ian McDermott's character, they're struggling in this. Natalie Portman's still a very young, quite inexperienced actor, and she's just lost. You can just see in some of her performances she's lost, but she's also given some of the worst dialogue. And again, this whole thing of not quite knowing whether her boyfriend, oh sorry, husband now, is a mass murdering psychopath or the love of her life. And Portman doesn't know how to lurch between those two. The script doesn't know how to work between those two. Mm. And so, again, for every scene you get of, hey, Samuel L. Jackson's been a bit of a dick to Anakin, that's setting up his path. Oh, Ian McDermott's tempting him subtly. That's Sammy's path. And he's like, no, we've got a completely unsettled thing here. And just the lurches in tone of this movie are extraordinary.
Yeah, well, talking of Padme, similar to my comments on her in our episode 2 show, the further she gets away from being that smart, measured, tactical queen of an entire planet in the first film, the more basic and sort of scatterbrained she becomes.
To the point where she dies of a broken heart.
Well,
what's that about?
I'll get to that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I mean, yes, she has her big line about how democracy dies to thunderous applause, and I think As far as that goes, she nails that line.
I actually had that as a point too. I think that's a great point in the film and it is a great point for her performance. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. But on the whole, she's given this very basic, I'm in love, I'm having a baby, la la la. And it's like her eyes are off the ball. She should have been onto Anakin in that field a movie ago where he's like, oh yeah, fascist dictatorships, are they really so bad? You know?
Yeah, I slaughtered a bunch of men, women and children. Let's kiss.
And even in this film, she doesn't push back on some pretty questionable stuff that he says. He even calls her a separatist at one point, and she just kind of lets it go.
Yeah.
She gets played by him pretty comprehensively for the whole film, which again doesn't scream that this is this capable, strategic kid from the first movie. I think she gets better lines mostly in this film than the second one, but her overall arc with her dying of that broken heart, yes, it's all a bit really for my taste. And if I was Natalie, I'd think Yeah, my character sucked in two of these three films.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really fair summation. Unfortunately, she was a strong character in The Phantom Menace, and that is lost. And again, it's that dead hand of the original trilogy reaching back and meaning, well, she can't make it out of episode three because she's not in episode four. But even then, they can't quite square the circle because it doesn't square with Leia in Return of the Jedi remembering her mum.
Exactly. Exactly. I was going to raise that if you didn't. You know, she absolutely had memories of her mother. Why couldn't Padme have been spirited away to Alderaan and live there maybe in secrecy and then died over time of some disease or something? That would give Leia the chance to have grown up with her and actually have those memories of her that she talks about in Return of the Jedi. Maybe it would have been too complicated to sort of suggest via the way this film ends with just these, here's what this character does, here's what that character does. But I would have tried to explain it, I think.
Yeah, look, I probably would have as well, but I think that Lucas also wanted the big finale and he wanted the funeral scene and all the rest of them to put a full stop on it. So yeah. I think he was sort of damned if he did, damned if he don't on that one. And that's what I'm saying, that, you know, these plot decisions are being driven as much as anything by where you leave the characters, not what's the best for the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yoda. I have a brief comment on Yoda, which might seem really strange, but it stood out for me a couple of times in this film, Dave. And that's the way he's just referred to as Yoda a few times in the film. Mace Windu says it in a scene, and I guess they're both on the Jedi Council, so I guess he gets away with calling him Yoda, although leaving off the honorific of Master feels really off. Like, would someone just refer to Mace as just Windu? Like, hey guys, I've sent Windu to check things out. You know, you would say Master Windu, just like you would say Master Yoda. And then later, Bail Organa refers to him as just Yoda. And I thought, that feels really off. I don't think he'd do that. He's married into royalty. He understands titles. And I don't think he's on a besties level anyway, where he could just drop the Master from Master Yoda and just say, oh yeah, Yoda. Yoda's going to do this. That's strange. Did that stick out to you, or am I just nitpicking?
It didn't particularly stick out to me. I think that they pull their punch with Yoda a bit here. He got the big sort of action scene, and it's not a bad scene where he's fighting Palpatine. But if you were doing this whole saga again properly, sort of plotting it out, Yoda's kind of the anti-hero or the bad guy in some ways of the first trilogy, because it's on Yoda's watch that the Jedi fall down and the Jedi fail. And Yoda spent 2.5 movies now sort of going, there's some Sith about, all right. Yep, got to watch out for those Sith. And doesn't do anything. He doesn't prepare the Jedi Council. He doesn't prepare the Jedi. He's just like, oh, there's some Sith.
Yeah.
Can't do anything about that. Oh, well. And then suddenly, you know, he's outmaneuvered, outgunned. And in some ways, you know, his lack of action is responsible for the fall of the Jedi Order. And if you were to really lean into that in Revenge of the Sith, that makes his plot in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi a redemption arc.
Yes.
And I think that would have been really, really cool. But because he's Yoda and everyone loves him, they're just like, no, just have him have a really cool fight scene and then he can hobble off with Jimmy Smits into his hovel. And I just think that they really pulled a punch there.
Yeah, although I do like the line, I think he says, into exile I will go. He knows he's been defeated. He knows he's messed up. And he sort of owns it there, where he says, I'm going into exile.
And that's a good moment and a good line, but they don't really lean into it or set it up. And I think that's a bit of a mistrick.
Yeah, fair enough.
So look, a real positive for me, although I do find the ease with which the Jedi are killed under Order 66 a bit baffling, and indeed the way that Palpatine takes out three Jedi Masters in, you know, 10 seconds.
Mm.
But I will say that the willingness of the movie to go dark is very cool. I think the music sells the Order 66 stuff far better than anything else does. I think the visuals actually don't work that well. There's lots of sort of, what was that? Oh, I'm dead. Like, it just, there's actually some quite comic deaths from some of those Jedi in that sequence, but the music sells it really, really well. And that, I think, gives it a pass. And it actually is pretty cool. The moment with the younglings is a good moment. I think it's done really, really well. And again, when I was talking to people in the office today, all of them mentioned that moment, particularly when they first saw it as a kid, of the younglings sort of coming in and the lightsaber ignites. Everyone remember that moment. It's a really good moment. So I think that although they pulled their punch on Yoda, they did land some punches on those ones. It's a shame that Order 66 has kind of been undone a little bit, because it seems that like every second bastard survived and, you know, got into a sequel TV series somewhere. Yeah. But they are good moments, and the movie's the better for them.
Yeah, one particularly bad death is the alias Sakura death. She's the blue, sexy alien with the midriff top. And she's just kind of, you know, walking along, hips are swaying, and she just gets shot in the back and falls down in the least dramatic way you can imagine.
Yeah, that was one that I was thinking of as well, yeah.
But the music does paper over the cracks. The music during that scene is really, really good. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's stunning, yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk choreography. Something I think that's worth highlighting is that the fight choreography was pretty mind-blowing in the first prequel and sort of took a backseat in the second. But when we get to the final duel in this film, Dave, McGregor and Christensen are really going at it. And in the docos, you see the work they put in to make it look so good. The duel is amazing. And watching Disney Star Wars in more recent years, where a combination of them, I think, not using such skilled choreography people and having actors who aren't really up to physical activity, plus probably very little time to learn fights, it leaves Disney Star Wars fights looking pretty tragic. You put them side by side with this, where McGregor and Christensen are two young, fit guys really wanting to have a go and having the luxury of learning the craft over, you know, some months, I think, in Sydney. It's just night and day. I know some people rave over the Rey and Kylo Ren fight from The Last Jedi where Snoke gets killed and the throne room burns down. But I think they're looking at the overall spectacle there and some of the party tricks that get used during the fight rather than the technical aspects of the fight itself. In that one, you have guys literally pulling their swings because they've arrived too early or too late. You even have some disappearing weaponry at times to sort of hide why Rey and Kylo aren't hit and killed. It's pretty terrible when you break it down. But this fight, the fight at the end of this film, is incredible, particularly the speed they do it at. And I don't believe the film is sped up because they're doing it at that speed in rehearsals.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this. I still maintain that the best lightsaber duel in the entire saga is the one in the Emperor's Throne Room, because it is well choreographed, it's exciting, but it's about something. It is about that confrontation between Luke and his father. This one, I never used to like. And when I saw it the first time, I remember just looking, going, oh, for God's sake, come on. You know, all of that sort of over-exaggerated stuff. And, you know, we're having a fight on, you know, a lava river and everything. I was just like, come on. But I that was unfair. And when I watched it this time for the first time in quite a while, I did actually get that level of what it's about and that confrontation between the former master and apprentice and all the rest of that. And I did see past the just over-the-top Lucas spectacle and got into it. So I think it probably is the best lightsaber duel of the prequel trilogy.
And look, I think what goes hand in hand with this comment, because you've mentioned too, they're fighting on lava, they're jumping on and off these little craft that are floating on the lava. I think this film is best in the prequels for effects work.
Oh, comfortably.
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? It's 3 years on from the second film, so you'd hope things would be better. That doesn't mean everything's perfect, though. They're still shying away from having actual guys in clone armor and things like that. Things that I think do hurt the film. When we get to the sequels, as horrible as they are, you know, though, that for the close-ups, we have guys in armor. Or even when Disney Star Wars does it in The Mandalorian or Andor, and it looks great. When there's guys clanking around in armor, it's real. And this film doesn't have that. But broadly speaking, the settings don't feel ultra fake to me like they do in the second film. This feels bigger, more expansive, more colorful, I think, than that sort of brown palette of the second film. It's pretty close to being real, and that's cool. I think this is a very pretty movie to look at on the whole.
I think the CGI is fantastic. I said that it was spectacular, particularly in that opening scene. I stand by that. I think that it lacks the really good mix of environments and some location work that Attack of the Clones had. I think that Attack of the Clones stands out for that Kamino set, which is different and weird. It stands out for the Lake Como stuff on Naboo. And I think that that's lacking here. Even when they go to the Planet of the Moths or whatever the hell it is, where Obi-Wan fights Grievous, that's still kind of just, you know, a cliff face with some holes in it. It's actually quite a dry and dull set, I think. So I give it top marks for the CGI effects, but I think it lacks some of that beauty that Attack of the Clones had in my mind.
Fair enough. We mentioned music as well, and I just want to say the big new piece of music introduced in this film, like Duel of Fates in the first film, Across the Stars in the second, is called Battle of the Heroes. And it's used to great effect at the start of the film during the space battle, but then really comes into its own with the lightsaber duel at the end that we've just been talking about. I think there's also some nice choral music in places. Williams is really on song here. Some nice Across the Stars callbacks too in places. You would have noticed those, Dave.
I did, yes.
No issues with the soundtrack for me. This is a good one.
Yeah, it's absolutely a very, very good one. A scene we need to talk about. I said that the whole point of this movie is basically to get Anakin Skywalker into the Darth Vader suit.
Yes.
So, you know, let's talk about that, because this is, again, just that George Lucas highs and lows all in one go. The surgery stuff is really good. The moment when the mask comes down, you get the point of view shot of the mask coming down. That's an awesome shot, and it was great when I saw it the first time. It's great now. But the moment of... you accidentally, how can I put this, killed her. No. Oh, that, I remember people laughing in the cinema at about 3 o'clock in the morning, as it was by then. And even now, I just watch that and go, that is just not how you do that scene. And it's such a shame, because the early stuff, as I say, that the mask coming down, awesome. And then you get the just terrible dialogue.
And the worst part of that is there's a knock-on effect into Return of the Jedi, which is just bizarre, because this film came out and is like, you know, you killed Padme. No! And everyone laughed at it. Everyone made fun of it. So what does Lucas do to Return of the Jedi? In the most up-to-date version of Return of the Jedi now, where the Emperor is zapping Luke, Vader turns and goes, no. And then picks up the Emperor and tosses him. It's like, why is he saying this? This kind of thing is silly. So people hate it, and you've inserted it? What? Yeah, it's terrible.
It's really, really bad. 2 points from me before we finish, Rob, and they're both slightly more pulling out rather than specific parts of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
When I watched Revenge of the Sith this time, I actually was able to do it with my two nieces, who are 10 and 7, and were seeing it for the first time. They've been roped into Star Wars through the Baby Jedi show or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And their dad's a massive Star Wars fan, so we've sort of been waiting for the moment when they're like, hey, Dad, can we watch Star Wars? And he's, oh, of course you can. So we got up to episode 3, and I did sort of sit down and watch them with them. And there were moments in there that I thought were a little bit cringe that they really loved. Palpatine's scream when he does the big twirly dive and takes out the Jedi. Ashley, who's 10, just looked at me and gone, that was cool.
It's a scary sound.
Yeah, and I just thought, you know what? I see that and sort of cringe a little. A 10-year-old sees that and just goes, that was cool. But the thing that was really interesting is they went into this movie with a vague knowledge that, you know, Darth Vader's the baddie in the next lot. But they don't know who Darth Vader is. And all through the movie, Ashley particularly, as I say, the 10-year-old was going, maybe he's going to be Darth Vader.
Oh,
and
really?
None of them were Anakin until the really last moment when she's just gone, oh, Anakin's going to be Darth Vader! That was a complete shock to her. And it was just a really awesome to kind of see that completely neutral take. And this is what I say, kids that grew up and this was the first Star Wars they saw without knowing all the other movies off by heart, I think will always take more out of this than we will.
How did she feel when that lovely, sexy Hayden with the bouncy, floofy hair catches on fire and burns up? How did that go down?
She was just sort of sitting there going, what's happening? Is he dead? Is he... No, he's still alive. Oh, what's going to happen? And then she's sort of like, oh, that's why he gets in the suit and everything. So... yeah,
she wasn't put off. It's quite violent and graphic, Dave.
Yeah, but it's almost cartoon violence. I mean, there's so much CGI in this, no one could assume it was real.
Right, okay.
You've got one more point, Rob.
I do have one more point before we go to the sports desk, Dave, and that's Sydney. I mentioned Sydney briefly in the Attack of the Clones review and how I'd been excited the film was shooting here and then so upset when it was a bit of a stinker. I felt it was a bit of a stain on my town's ability to make movies. But with this one, I think, whew, We turned out something good. And again, our locals didn't write it, direct it, produce it. I know all that too. But the local film industry helped make a film that's great to watch. And as we touched on right back at the start, is the fan favorite of the three films. And so there was some redemption there for me 3 years on from just being mortified that we'd made this horrible, horrible film. I mean, you like the second film, but I hate it. So I was mortified.
Yep, fair enough. Look, the last thing I want to mention, and it again is a bit more of a meta sort of discussion point. I'm a big fan, as I know you are, Rob, of the guys at Red Letter Media, the YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
And they have some quite funny, but also quite insightful, long-form video reviews of the prequel saga. But they make a point in the review of this that I think is really worth mentioning, and that is how close they got to a really good idea but didn't quite land. And that is the whole theme of seeing the demise of democracy and the demise of liberty and freedom and how that comes about. And you know, that oft-quoted line about this is how democracy falls to thunderous applause. The movie's kind of leading into that, but it doesn't quite do it. And they sort of postulate that what would have worked is if you'd seen the effect of the Clone Wars. You know, the Republic's been at war for 5 years, and that means that people are hungry, things are run down, industry is not churning out luxuries, it's churning out war materials, and you make Coruscant and the Republic Germany after World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And you make it that sort of a just desperate, down and out, struggling society, and that's the sort of society that produces a Hitler or an emperor. And they really could have just talked about how everything worked. And to finish on this point, Rob, I've often said that the big flaw of Star Wars is that it's not really about this community or the society or the world. It's about a few chosen heroes in a very small speck of the galaxy doing a few cool hero stuff. And you really don't appreciate why the Empire's bad and how it affects people and why it needs to be fought against. And that's, I think, a big problem with this movie. You don't really understand why the transition from Chancellor to Emperor actually matters, other than the space wizards don't like the other space wizards. And that's why movies like Rogue One and TV shows like Andor, we just absolutely adore. I know we both do.
Yeah.
I think it's it gets closer than the others, but I think it could have done so much more with the points I wanted to make.
That's a really interesting point of view. And obviously, I don't have notes on this, so I'm just going to riff now based on my Star Wars sort of knowledge and background. I guess in the film, what we're seeing is that Coruscant really is at the center of the known universe sort of thing. So all these fights that Palpatine's been engineering, he's been engineering more on the fringes of the galaxy and keeping them away from Coruscant. So Coruscant's been allowed to stay this shining jewel. Although at the start of this film, I guess the inference is that the war has finally made it to Coruscant and you have this big fleet action above Coruscant. The Separatists obviously haven't been there for very long, so they haven't done much damage to Coruscant, and that's where the war ends before things get bad. But what would have been interesting, and this comes back to something I've mentioned since the first episode, start the first episode with maybe the theme of episode 2, where two Jedi having jolly adventures get caught up in a plot that leads to the Clone Wars. The second film is the Clone Wars. And, you know, they could still make a Clone Wars TV series that fleshed out more battles and all that sort of stuff. So it's not like taking away from that, because I guess what Lucas wanted to do was say, begun the Clone Wars have at the end of episode 2 and at the start of episode 3 they're over, and then he's going to tell the rest in TV shows. But you could have still had the Clone Wars in the second episode, fleshed it out on TV, and then when you get to the third episode, have actually shown the effects of that on Coruscant to tie in with what these guys must have been talking about on their show. I think that would have worked marvelously, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. And I'm really just riffing based on what I know, what could have been. Oh, yeah, Dave, I like that idea a lot. And it does sell why people would support a Hitler type. Absolutely.
Yeah, and your point about the war reaching Coruscant is a really good one. My favourite episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine is In the Pale Moonlight, and that's the episode where the Dominion that the Federation is at war with invade Beta Zed, which is where Diana Troy comes from. It's this lovely, lush, beautiful, perfect world at the heart of the Federation, and suddenly they go, well, the war's now come home. It's right at the heart of the Federation. we need to do things we would never, ever think of doing before if we're going to win this war. And I think that's what we should have really seen. We should have seen the population and even some of the Jedi maybe or some of the Senate going, we would never have countenanced this before, but we're desperate. This has to happen. Yep, maybe we go with an emperor. And look, this probably sums up the problem with the movie in that if you're 10, you don't give a toss about any of that.
No.
You just want cool space action. If you're a dedicated Star Wars fan, you know, who basically wants Andor the movie, you do. And I think that you could judge this movie in very various different ways.
I was about to say, we're kind of aiming for the Andor take on this.
Yeah, but there's lots of people who go, I didn't care, it was just a cool action movie. And on that level, I can't deny it works.
Yeah, because, I mean, we don't see the man on the street or the woman on the street. At least in episode 2, we went down into bars and we saw that people, you know, go drinking in bars and take death sticks. And we went to Dex's Diner and saw that people like 1950s diners on Coruscant, you know, go and have a burger there, you know, maybe a Nerf steak or something, I don't know. But in this, we don't really get down on street level. We don't see what people think. I don't think we even see people looking up into the sky and thinking, good Lord, Anakin Skywalker's about to crash half a ship down onto onto this conveniently located landing strip. You know, we don't get anything, sort of any reaction from the populace at all, let alone an in-depth one like, ooh, here's what we think and here's what we're going to do about it. No.
No. And whilst I think we would have preferred that movie, a lot of people wouldn't have. So what do we know?
True enough. Shall we go to the sports desk?
Let's go.
Here we are at the sports desk where we do the play of the week, the foul of the week, and the player of the week. Dave, do you want to lead off with your play of the week?
Well, Rob, as I said earlier, I had a couple of options here. One of them was the opening battle, but I settled on a very particular moment, and that is the moment where Anakin decapitates Dooku. Because that was the moment when I first saw it, that was the moment when I watched it again, where I remember just sitting there going, they're not going to do that. They're not going to go that far. Wow, they've done it. And that was the moment I just thought, okay, I'm just now starting to buy this guy can become Darth Vader and that this is going to be a darker and more serious movie. It was very well shot. It was very well done. It didn't pull the punch and it was just a really good, effective moment at the start of the movie.
Yeah, and I did mention at the start of this episode, that is the moment I think people are meant to see that his downfall is really starting, you know, where the Emperor is like, you know, kill him. And he does.
Yeah.
Even though he does have these sort of Boy Scout ideals about what the Republic is and what you should do with prisoners, etc. Yeah.
It's the ultimate just following orders moment.
Absolutely. My play of the week, I'm going for something super obvious, but I've waxed lyrical about it, so how could I not? It's that duel at the end of the film. I just think it's so well choreographed. I think it's something that people... Back in the 80s, I don't know where it first came up. It did come from Lucas that he had said Darth Vader becomes Darth Vader by falling into a lava pit. And we all knew this as fans somehow. I don't know where it was written. Maybe it was in an annual or magazine somewhere or something. So we had known this would happen for literally decades. And so for them to finally go to the lava planet and have this big, long duel that starts here and continues there and goes all over the place. And I take on board, you know, you're saying, oh, they're jumping from here to there on these floating barges and things. It's a little far-fetched, but I think it really sells it. I think it's the cherry on top as far as lightsaber duels in the prequels go. I mean, because what? In episode 2, we had a lot of Christopher Lee fighting and Yoda fighting, and Christopher Lee was played by a stuntman and Yoda was just a piece of CGI. It wasn't two dudes actually learning the moves, like hundreds of choreographed moves to do one after the other. And I think they do it so well, and it's so amazing to look at. I love that scene, Dave.
No, very fair. Keep us going with your foul of the week, Rob.
Oh, Dave, there's a few moments in this film where I think, that was a bit clunky. But I'm going with something you mentioned earlier, so I didn't sort of jump on it and join in because I knew I had to talk about it now at the end of the show. And it's where Anakin basically susses out that Palpatine is a Sith. He even has his saber ignited and on him for most of the scene, like pointed at him. He's at his absolute Boy Scout, this is wrong sort of mindset. But then it ends with him saying, you know, well, anyway, I'm going to go now. See ya. which seems like the most dangerous and stupid thing to do when you've ratted out a Sith Lord, given away that you're onto them, even threatened them with your weapon. Do you then just go and wander off? If it was my script, I would have had him figure it out much more covertly and then go to Mace with that. Like have Palpatine, you know, going on about, you know, the Sith and how I've studied them and all of this. And Anakin's looking around the room realizing, oh, hell, that's Sith art on the wall. And, oh, that's a disguised lightsaber on his desk. And then just leaving with a smile, you know, not giving the actual game away that he knows the score. It's incomprehensible that you tell the bad guy, I'm on to you, I should take you in right now. But you know what? I won't. I'm just going to go for now. Bye. That's terrible. Terrible, Dave.
We are very close to a snap, but not quite.
Oh, really?
My foul is the whole scene that includes the confrontation between Palpatine and Windu. It's the whole scene that contains the no, no, no. It
no.
contains the unlimited power. It contains the no, I need him to leave. It contains the like charred remains of Samuel L. Jackson bouncing up and down. It's so bad. It's so many embarrassing, cringy moments all in the space of about 4 minutes. And it's just terrible.
And all of that runs together as one sequence, really, because what I'm talking about...
Is the one before it.
Is the scene before, because then he goes to Samuel L. Jackson and goes, he is a Sith Lord. And Samuel L.'s like, well, thanks for telling us, buddy. You stay here and we'll take care of him. And then that leads into the scene you're talking about. So it's like this one 20-minute segment of the film we're talking about as really, a foul.
It's a really bad sort of 10, 15 minutes, absolutely.
Wow. Well, to make us feel better, hit us with your player of the film.
I feel like this could be a snap, Rob. I'm going with Ewan McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's been pretty good all through the trilogy, but he holds a lot of things together in this one. There's a level of calm about his performance. There's a level of assuredness about his performance. There's a level of charm about his performance. And he just makes anything he's in work a little bit better. And I think that having not given him Player of the Week yet, I am for this final one.
Snap.
I thought it was going to be. I didn't think I could see any alternative.
Yeah, like I was waxing lyrical earlier about some of the subtle acting he does and all of that. Obi-Wan is also just a major character in the film. Anakin is much more likable in this film. Hayden Christensen does exactly what's being asked of him, as you were talking about earlier. But it does lead to all these sort of, I'm going in this direction now. Now I'm going in that direction. And it's a, yeah. It's a bit all over the place. Whereas Obi-Wan's just nice and, oh, he just flows through the whole film just beautifully. Ewan McGregor is my man for this. So, snap-o.
Perfect. And a score, Rob.
Yeah, look, as a score and a summary, I came out of this film back in 2005 thinking that is by far the best of the three films. I've never deviated from that. I think it looks good. I think the story works. I think the clunky moments, because there are clunky moments, whether a visual or a line of dialogue or whatever, are still the lowest amount of clunky dialogues in the three films. They're definitely there, but I find less things to really hammer on in this film. And I think the Lord of the Rings style ending, where we see multiple scenes in multiple places for different characters as the score just carries it along, is really nice. Do remember, folks, at the time, this was the last Star Wars film. That's how it was promoted. This was the last film. George said, I'm only going to do six, and this is it. I felt very emotional at the end, walking out of the cinema, and I'd still throw an 8 out of 10 at this as a film. Parts of it even feel better than 8 out of 10 for me, but overall, as a film, I think 8 is fair.
I appreciated this film a lot more watching it again this time. Mm-hmm. I still don't enjoy it quite as much as Attack of the Clones. I still think that Attack of the Clones is the only one of this trilogy that has a very clear start, middle, and end, a very clear plot that works with a number of nice set pieces and a number of nice locations. Revenge of the Sith has some very cool action moments and some kind of dull action moments. It has just a few too many WTF moments for me. And as I've said before, the dead hand of the original saga coming back to just sort of break plot and break characters to put them all where they need to be and still not quite getting it right, I think just means that this doesn't quite stand on its own as a movie. I think that it is just a sort of a piece of a saga in a way that I think Attack of the Clones does stand ahead as a movie. I don't think it's terrible. I don't hate it. I don't think it's much better than The Phantom Menace. I'm going to give it a B minus, which is close to Attack of the Clones, but it's not quite there for me. But with the caveat, I think if I first saw this at the age of 8, this would absolutely be my favourite of the three, and I totally get why.
Well, talking of your nieces, and they seemed to have a good reaction to it, did they think it was the best of the three?
They did, yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe I just have an 8-year-old mindset, Dave. Or a 10-year-old mindset.
maybe. But in a month's time, it is, of course, May the 4th, and so my brother-in-law have agreed we're going to take them to go see Star Wars.
Oh, really?
In the cinema, yep. So they will get to see Star Wars for the first time in the cinema as it was meant to.
Oh, that is fantastic. I bet they're looking forward to that.
Yeah, very, very much so.
Well, I mean, it's the next in line for them, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. It's perfect.
Oh, can you show them Rogue One before that?
We had a chat. We decided we'll do the saga movies first and then sort of do the other ones.
Okay. That would have been an interesting experiment, though. Because I don't know anyone, because everyone my age has seen all the films first, so Rogue One came as sort of an insert. Whereas they're in a position, Dave, where they could see Rogue One before Episode 4.
Well, my brother-in-law did originally have a plan that he would do it all in order. So, you know, we'd have to watch all of the Clone Wars and all of Rebels in the right spot. And then he just realised that isn't happening.
That's
just
insane.
Too much. Let's just do the saga movies in order and then we'll work out where they want to be. Plus, I think Rogue One's probably a little too much for a 7-year-old.
Yeah, fair enough. I've had a lot of fun doing this.
Yeah, I have too. I'm glad we've done it. Listeners, if you've enjoyed this set of alternate galaxies, please let us know ideas for movies we can do in the future or series we can do in the future. We've obviously got our Doctor Who hot takes coming up in May and June, so that will probably take up a lot of our time. But Rob, you have issued a challenge to me for potentially later in the year. Do you want to share with the listeners what that is?
You want to talk about that now? Okay. Listeners, tell me what you think of this. I've said to Dave, how about we do the Lord of the Rings films?
And you've said this to me, Rob, because you know I haven't got past the first half hour of Fellowship of the Ring.
Correct.
So the challenge is, and I've been saying for about 5 or 10 years, you know, I need to sit down and actually work through the Lord of the Rings. So
yes,
maybe this is the excuse for me to do it. So if we did that, listeners, let us know if you're keen. Rob would be coming to it as an expert. I'll be coming to it as a first-time viewer.
Very interesting. Please write in and just let Dave know they're really okay. He will get something out of them, I promise.
Absolutely. But not look, Doctor Who hot takes before we get to anything like that.
Oh, yeah, they've got to come first.
But that's been fun, but it is time to wrap this up. Don't forget, we have the Doctor Who show coming in a week's time where we're talking about who killed Kennedy, and we'll, of course, have our, as we always do for our novels, a separate plot summary just so you don't have to read the whole book yourself, coming out a couple of days before.
Looking forward to it.
Fantastic. But until then, I've been Dave.
And I've been Rob.
We will definitely speak again soon.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Alternate Galaxies, the podcast where Rob and Dave from The Doctor Who Show take a look at other great sci-fi and fantasy that we think Doctor Who fans might like. You can reach us at hello@thedwshow.net, on Twitter @thedwshow, or on Facebook /thedwshow. Alternate Galaxies is an irregular podcast, so stay tuned to The Doctor Who Show and other programs on our feed to know when the next episode's coming. Our theme music is called Wretched Destroyer and is by Kevin MacLeod. Find him at incompetech.com. Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.